A little review then. Not a long, laborious one, just a little one. We talked last week about this very important, very paradigm-shifting idea that creation is dynamic, not static. That it's not something that just gets visited upon the story and remains as it is until it shifts in some platonic way from perfect to imperfect and then remains statically imperfect until it is made perfect again. It's actually, creation is endowed with generative capacity, with the ability to make more of what God has made. And that we are put into that story to guide and nurture and care for that generative dynamic creation so that it never loses its ability to provide, never loses its capacity to do what God made it to do. And we also talked about Carl Sagan's comments from his article, Pale Blue Dot, A Vision of the Human Future in Space. And we tried to look at a picture of Earth in space, and it was even less visible here than in the original photograph because of the light and so on. But this little wee dot of light that we call home, and Sagan's insistent perspective that there is nowhere but here. And that's a very, very important idea that we did some looking at, and we spent some time talking about the possible dialogue between that idea that there's nowhere but here and the Christian understanding of the cosmos. So we were exploring in the first two chapters of Genesis, in which, just a reminder to those that were here, and a fresh idea perhaps to those that weren't, just a reminder that in the first two chapters of Genesis, there is, in fact, nowhere but here. To the ancient mind, this idea of the bifurcation of heaven and earth, that's a foreign idea. And it's a foreign idea to the first two chapters of Genesis as well, and it's also, curiously enough, an idea that in the last two chapters of the Bible, in the last two chapters of Revelation, is revisited when the kingdom of God comes to earth and God is with his people and there's a new heaven and a new earth. And God is here with us, not somewhere else, making all things new. Interesting. And I said that this week we would talk a bit about what falls between those two sections of the Bible, which of course is all the rest. And so I hope your coffee cup's full, because this could take a little while. What's that?
So,
oh, man. So what we really need to do is stop and pray about the coffee. You guys are doing awesome, considering. Does Atticus need some coffee? Man, he's cute, eh? You did good, guys. Well, we'll start anyway. And if when the coffee's ready, we just sort of stop all this deep thought and go get coffee, that's all good. All right, indeed. The first two chapters of Genesis, of course, are followed, because of the logic of these things, by chapter 3. And in chapter 3, the story shifts just a little, right? Now, I've been banging away at this idea of starting the story with the first two chapters, because a lot of times in Christendom, it seems like, for some curious reason, we start telling the story in chapter 3, not in chapter 1. We start telling the story of what matters. We set up the problem of the story, the thing that we're wrestling with, as though it actually comes in chapter 3, with, call it the fall, call it human depravity, call it the introduction of sin to the narrative, call it whatever you want to call it. But a lot of times in Christendom, we don't start at the beginning. We don't begin at the beginning. We begin in chapter 3, as though that were the beginning. And it's not. And that's very, very important. That's not an unimportant chapter. That's not an unimportant event that narrative talks about. I mean, we all live with the substance of that part of the narrative in different ways every day, don't we? But it's not the way the story begins, and it's not the way the story ends, and we'll come back to that. But I want to talk a little bit about what happens in chapter 3 this morning. There's lots of different ways that we could understand that part of the story. And the way that I'm going to focus on this morning is to suggest that what happens in the third chapter of Genesis could be described as the disruption of shalom. So this concept of shalom, not a concept that's native to most of our language, a Hebrew concept. And I made some attempt last week to help us consider the ancient language of the text as well as their stories. And so I want to do that with this word too, because it's a really important word, a very important picture. What we have in the first two chapters of Genesis is this a very lovely, very compelling picture. And one way to sum up what that picture is about is to say it's a picture of shalom. And to the Hebrew mind, what shalom is generally its wholeness, peace, well-being, health. Those kind of things are all bundled into shalom. So it's a very significant word. And there are several different aspects to the picture of shalom that we find right at the beginning of the story in the poem and the narrative of Genesis 1 and 2. We see in those first two chapters that there is shalom with God and humans. We see that there is shalom with God and the rest of creation. We see that there is shalom between the elements of creation. We see that there is shalom between the people in the story. We see that there is shalom between the people and the soil, between the people and the things of the earth, and the rest of what God has made. And that's how the story begins, with this beautiful picture. And then what happens when sin enters the story is that that is disrupted. And one way, if we're thinking about this idea of sin, which is really unappealing thing to think about, right? I mean, unpopular, absolutely. One of those kind of concepts that, because I think so often the story has been told in Christendom starting in chapter 3, that a lot of people feel like it's what's perking away underneath everything all the time when people are trying to tell the story of God and humanity, right? What you're really talking about is, you know, sin. If we were to try to think about what that idea means, the idea of sin, I think one way that I've found helpful to think about it in my own life, if I'm trying to ask myself, is what I'm doing right or wrong? One way that I can get my imagination engaged that feels healthy to me is ask, is there any way in which I am guilty of disrupting shalom? Is what I'm doing here disruptive to shalom? And that gives me some pretty good clues about the merit or demerit of what I'm doing or not doing. We talked last week about this idea of harmony within hierarchy. This idea that in those first two chapters of the story, there is what would have been, to the people to whom the story was told, a radical hierarchy revealed. And that hierarchy, first of all, separates God from everything else. A crazy thought to the ancient mind. Because the gods were so embedded. The gods in the ancient mind were like humans, but on steroids. Like, whatever we do, they just did, but size extra large. You know, like, if we're... Anyway, pick a thing. I'm not going to start diagramming that, because it just gets sorted really quickly. So, the idea that God was separate from all of that is a very, very significant one. So we have God, and God makes this generative creativity, this creative stuff, with the ability to make more stuff. And then into that story, God here, endowed creativity here, God places the humans. And the humans are in this story to care for and to nurture and to guide that dynamic generative creativity. And so that's that harmony within hierarchy idea. So if we take that idea and we think about the idea of shalom as cooperating with that structure for the cosmos, if we think about the seeking of shalom as striving to live in such a way that that hierarchy stays in its right order. That's a pretty interesting framework, among other things, I think a pretty interesting framework for our moral imagination. The part of our life that asks the question, is this right or wrong? We live with enormously complex issues in our time. We live with the kind of information that we're getting about from science. We live with questions that have to do with things at such a microscopic level that are so fundamental to the shape of humanity. We're on the brink of fiddling with the human blueprint from the inside out in ways that we never ever have been before. And so we have to make moral, ethical, societal, cultural decisions about all this stuff. And they're not always easy to frame. Those things can be incredibly complex. When Dave comes back after his surgery, he's going to be part robot. That's right. So how many parts would Dave have to have that were not germane to the way he arrived here before he would be more robot? That's how it never comes to that. I'm just illustrating with you as though I had the right to.
This isn't going to be on the podcast, is it?
Tim, do you mind editing the podcast? So this is the terrain we're in, right? The idea of nanobots, the idea that we're going to put technology into the bloodstream in order to deal with things from the inside out in the human body. Crazy. Never mind the things that have to do with procreation and our interventions and engagement with those functions of humanity. So we've got these enormous things that we're wrestling with that we have to frame. And then we have the everyday stuff, right? All the normal things that challenge us where we're constantly kind of going, what's the right thing to do here? What's the life-giving thing to do here? So this is why we would lay out this kind of a framework. Why we would lay out something that is so grand, if you want, that it can include those kind of wrestlings. Maybe this is a little bit like a marriage vow. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but a traditional marriage vow, it's absurd. And anybody who's ever been married knows how absurd this I will never, I will always business is, right? I mean, you, good luck with that. So it's aspirational. We can all acknowledge that, right? This is what I mean to do. But I will, all me, all you, everything included, that kind of a vow. You know why we make a vow like that when we make a commitment like marriage? We make a vow like that not because we actually think we can pull it off, but because it provides such a hugely inclusive framework that nothing falls outside of it. And so within that framework of that vow, we can wrestle with anything. And what we don't get with a vow like that is an out. We don't get, this is why the idea of contractual relationships just assails the heart of the matter, because it removes that imaginative hedge around the relationship that says there's nothing that falls outside of this. It's within this framework that we will wrestle with this. And if we succeed on a given day, it's within that hedge of that vow. If we fail, it's because somehow we crashed into that hedge and we just kind of went right through it. And some of us know the pain of that. It's a new place, right? Same kind of thing. Harmony and hierarchy. It's such a grandly inclusive idea that there's nothing that falls outside of it. So when we're thinking about how we discern right and wrong, when we're thinking about what will disrupt shalom, one way to think about it is, does what I'm going to do or not do mess with this hierarchy? Is there something about what I'm about to do that essentially says to God, I don't like the order of the cosmos, I don't like that you're at the top and I'm in the middle and I'm at the bottom, you're in my seat. And I want to be at the top of the hierarchy. What does that look like? What does it look like to displace God? Well, let me kind of give you an example. Let's think about, for a second, about something like substance abuse. One of the ways we can understand the abuse of substance is that it gives us occasion to put into our hands and into our bodies things that cause us to have the kind of experience that displace, in a temporary way, the terrain in our psyche and in our lived experience that is meant to be occupied by God. I don't know how many of you, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, goodness, but how many of you have ever wrestled with an addiction, but if you ever have, or if you've ever been close to somebody that has, you know by experience what it's like to sit with someone or to be someone who says, my brain knows, my mind knows the illogic of this, the insanity of this, but I keep doing it anyway. This stuff is incredibly powerful. Why is it so powerful? Well, because, among other things, of where it comes in the hierarchy. This stuff has this kind of horsepower because this is what it's messing with. It's messing with this grand framework for the cosmos. It's messing with shalom. It's messing with health, wellness, peace, as given to us in those first two chapters of the story. So one way to think about what's right and what's wrong, one way to think about the thing that we often call sin, is to think about it as the disruption of that hierarchy. We could also think about what's right and what's wrong in terms of participation. And in Genesis 1 and 2, we have this picture of a dynamic creation. We're placed in that situation to participate in the nurturance of life. And then in Genesis 3, what comes into the story is the introduction of death and the ways of death. Which is sort of dead obvious that that runs counter to this nurturance of life, right? That it's just kind of a head-on collision with that. And if we kind of think about this in those terms, then one way for us to think about sin is to ask, in what ways am I participating in the ways of life versus the ways of death? Am I doing things that take the blessed world that God has made in the direction of shalom? Or am I doing things that run counter to that? And the shape of my participation in this dynamic realm of creation gives me some pretty important clues about the merit of what I'm doing, whether I'm doing what is good or what is not good. There's one more idea here that might have been one that, if you grew up Christian, you might have grown up with this one. There is, of course, a Hebrew word for sin that is an archery term. It has to do with missing the mark. Is what the word actually means. It's a curious thing. My recollection of that use of that word, as I recall it from growing up, is that the mark that was being missed was almost always a moral boundary marker. The mark that was being missed was usually a behavioral one. You're doing the wrong thing. You know, stop that. You'll go blind. I mean, whatever, right? Like, there's some mark that's being missed here. So, always interesting to see who understands which references. But there's some behavior, right, that about which somebody uses that Hebrew word. You miss the mark. What if those kind of moral boundary markers, as significant as they may be, what if they're not the mark that Hebrew word is referring to? What if the mark that word is referring to is shalom? What if the mark is this compelling picture of what is beautiful and good and right and lovely that we get in the first two chapters of the story? I don't know what that does for you, but one of the things it does for me, some people just listen to that idea and go, well, you just rip the whole framework out of right and wrong. You just took away all the rules. Maybe. Or maybe what that idea does is it makes the boundary marker grandly inclusive, instead of narrowly prescriptive. Maybe what we have in the idea of shalom is something that actually moves well enough from place to place that it can work in more than one culture, it can work in more than one time, it can work for more than one group of people who behave the same around the boundary markers. Maybe that idea just got way bigger, not way smaller. Maybe it just made way more room for our moral imagination, for our agency in this story, for us to actually behave like the beings that are in the middle of the hierarchy of the cosmos, placed there to imaginatively, creatively, consistently, lovingly nurture what is good and what is right. I like it. One of the things that it does for me is it just says to me immediately, it says, this is a wildly different way to think about what is right and wrong than the static way of thinking about it as in or out. And I think that's super important. Not least of all because we often have to make decisions about right and wrong that are not that crisp. Right? It's not always dead obvious what's right and what's wrong. It really does feel a lot of the time like we are muddling around in gray jello when it comes to making these kind of decisions. Well, that's very distressing for the human mind and soul if we believe that our job is to find some kind of platonic clarity about this, some kind of static either-or clarity about these decisions. If we believe that God structured the cosmos so that, and then put us in it so that we could bifurcate the cosmos into right and wrong, we can say with absolute clarity, this is always right, this is always wrong, there's no situation in which that rule does not hold, then the instant we find ourselves in a situation where that rule does not hold, our cognitive dissonance goes through the roof, and we know we can't succeed. We can't succeed in our task. We can't succeed in the reason that we were placed here. But what if why we were placed here was actually to seek shalom? What if what we were placed here to do was to pursue that picture that we get in the first two chapters of this story? And what if we are actually charged? What if our agency in the middle of this story is actually so substantial that we are given the freedom to sift and to sort things that are not absolutely clear? What if this is more about direction than it is about a rule? What happens to our moral imagination if we make that kind of shift in framework? To me, it just, the world blossoms into possibilities. It just something, I don't know, like I'm not doing a good job of this. So you figure it out. But it just explodes into what could be. I can
get up there at 30,000 feet and just have a party all by myself, you know, but I want to try to bring this home a little bit.
Because there are implications from this. There are implications to this idea that we were made to seek a way of life that is consistent with shalom. And as I've sort of presented this idea of the kingdom here and the kingdom coming here and a new creation and a new heaven and a new earth and all things made new, very briefly, we haven't really explored that much, I've just kind of laid it out there as a possibility. But if we think about this idea within that framework, you know, one of the things that we actually end up being charged with doing here, what we're actually here to do, is to consistently seek a way of life that the story, as we have it in Revelation, at the end of the story, the written story of our text, that the end of our written story says that way of life now becomes permanent. So let me try to say that a little more succinctly, because that was sort of the thinking out loud series of sentences. If this idea that we are placed here to nurture and care for and order the world in the direction of shalom, what we are actually placed here to do is to begin to make the thing that at the end of this iteration of the heavens and the earth, the Bible says becomes permanent and lasts forever. You get it? You get that we're here to make something that God already says is good and very good, but we all know there's stuff about it that's not ideal. And then at the end, what happens is there's a new beginning to the story, and there's another chapter, a new heaven and a new earth is what Scripture calls it, in which the thing that we've been building is finished and permanent. It's not a different thing. It's not somewhere else. This is not about a disembodied evacuation of this story.
Yeah. It's a different way of thinking about it, isn't it? And for me, anyway, man, the implications just spill over. Let's think about it this way. Let's think about business for a moment. If we could understand business as the fair exchange of goods for a fair price, so all of us are in this exchange of work and wage and the things that we need, and all of that is rooted in the common good, let's say. So let's take that as our kind of working definition of business. An exchange in which everyone gets something that they need. Then if there's some merit to this idea of this Hebrew word of dasha that we talked about, this generative power of God's good creation, then what happens in business, essentially, under the idea of dasha, is that creation, which is the raw stuff that God has made, right? The good stuff that's already here. What happens is that stuff does what it's supposed to do. It sprouts, which is what the word dasha means, right? It produces more of what it is made to produce. And from that raw stuff, we make the goods, the houses, the food, the clothes, and so on, that we trade, with which we do business. So already, business as an idea, under this way of thinking about the nature of the world in which we live, is us participating with what God has made that is good in this dasha, in this generative creativity, all right? And beyond all of that, whatever our motives might be in working in being in business, we are participating in the building and ordering of creation, for good or for ill. That's what's going on when we do business. But then beyond that, there lies the possibility that we do business so that we can further shalom. That's why we're trading. That's why we're buying and selling. That's why we're tilling the soil or choosing not to. I heard this past week about the idea of businesses being invited to consider something called a triple bottom line. And that idea basically is that there's a group of people that were inviting businesses to think not just about their fiscal bottom line, about the buying and selling and profit part, but also about the bottom line of how the way they do business affects the environment and the bottom line of how the way they do business affects people. Triple bottom line. Interesting idea. When we start to think like this, we can see pretty clearly that doing business is an essential, it's even an integral part of the ordering of creation and working towards shalom. And I kind of picked on business for a couple of reasons. One is because I encountered this week, and so it was kind of this lovely real-time picture, and I'll talk about that in a moment.
But the other is because I grew up in a world in which, and in a household, and I love my family, and this is not a critique, I think we were just of a time, idea-wise. But I grew up in a world in which there was present this idea that there is a strata to what you do as regards God's pleasure in it. And that there was kind of this hierarchy, you know, and if you did business so you could make money, so you could give it to the people that were doing the real thing. You know, that we're in ministry, right? And look where I ended up. And you know, so some of us grew up with this, right? This idea that there's a holier way to make your living, a less holy way to make your living, and some unholy ways to make your living, and at the top is ministry. Okay. This idea assails that idea very directly. Participating in shalom is not hierarchical, except as it pertains to our place in the cosmos. And all human endeavor in that idea, all human endeavor, has within it equal opportunity for us to further shalom.
So I went by Tom Bargan's this week for the first time, and I was watching TJ make some people coffee, and then how many of you have been to Tom Bargan's already? Yeah, look at that. That's awesome. If you haven't, you should. I was watching TJ make some coffee, and then he made me some lovely blueberry rooibos tea. And I'm watching him make this tea, and it was like, I couldn't decide if I was watching a painter or a magician or an alchemist or a dancer, or like what was going on. It was like watching somebody make art. And it was all this really focused, joyful attention being lavished on this thing that was being made. And it was shalom in a cup. It was awesome, man. It was good tea. But it wasn't, the tea wasn't the shalom, of course. The tea is the object that was being made, you know? But the way it was being invested in, just, for me, it was just reverent with this. And I thought, there is a way to do this everyday thing called run a coffee shop that has woven into it so deeply, so richly, the thing that is the nurturance of shalom. And you see, there's no realm that is exempt from this. There's no strata of life that is exempt from this. I won't take you down this path in any details or anything, but when I started chasing this down in my imagination, it didn't take me very long before I went, okay, what's lovely about every broken version? Every uncooperative thing. Where's the realm, for example, for,
let's pick an obvious target. Where's the realm for Eros?
Where's the shalom of what's erotic? Wrestle with that one for a while. See what it does to your imagination about what might be lovely about that realm of human endeavor. What does health and wellness and wholeness look like? Yeah. And what does it look like to nurture? I think we have a pretty good picture of what the busted version is like. What's the other version look like? Or do we when we get into the tricky terrain, and I picked the example because I think it's powerful and egregious and all sorts of things, and it's right in front of us all the time. What do when we get into the tricky bits? Well, the simple thing to do is to revert to the previous way of thinking. The simple thing to do is to go back to either or. And take an entire realm of the world and say, that realm, that has nothing to do with shalom. That whole realm is just busted, and the only way it's going to be well is on the other side of some cosmic event where this platonic shift happens and everything that's imperfect becomes perfect again, and we really don't have anything to do with that as Christians or followers of the way of Christ, except just stay the hell away. Great. So if all the people, if we take seriously the idea of nurturing shalom, if all the people who take seriously that idea step away from the tricky, messy bits, who's fiddling with them? And what motivates them? Do you really think that there's anybody in the industry that we just now commonly acknowledge as a massive one in our culture, the pornographic industry, for example, who really is thinking about triple bottom line? How the way that I do business affects my profitability. How the way that I do business affects the people. How the way that I do business affects the environment. I'm thinking the middle one's missing, for sure. Anyway, it's just an example. We could pick anyone. I wanted one that whatever. It would make us think, because we got to think about this. Anyway, so when I'm at Tom Bargains, I'm seeing something so different than that. I believe that if we believe that the stuff that we're working with is essentially materially good because God made it that way. I don't believe the world's materially fallen, by the way, just so you know. I don't believe it's biologically fallen. I don't think science bears it out. I don't think human experience bears it out. There's lots of people who contend with me about that. But it's an important idea. I think that if we don't think of the world as materially fallen, if we think of it as essentially materially good because God made it that way and blessed it, then we can start stepping away from dualistic thinking about what's truly good. And we can start stepping away from this nonsense of a two-tiered occupational world. We can start stepping away from that same kind of world when it comes to other things like the realm of art. The whole way of thinking just falls apart if we take seriously the goodness of what God has made and the idea that in the end, heaven comes here and all things are made new. Under this idea of the nurturance of shalom, whatever my craft is, whatever my business is, whatever my trade is, I can get up in the morning and I can go off to ordering the stuff of creation in the interest of increased shalom, of increased equitable sharing of the common good, knowing without a doubt that I am doing the co-creative work that God made me for. And I think that's an awesome idea. Just for a brief moment, think about how this would apply to the realm of art. Excuse me. I have a cold and I feel strongly. It's an awfully messy combination. I was at the Masterworks anniversary, 20th anniversary show, Night to Remember, last night with Tyrion and Taya. Taya's a dancer, Tyrion isn't. They both liked it, which says an awful lot about the show. There are a number of people in this community that are very involved in that. And Kim is here, and Rand is here, and Jen's here, and Naomi was here, but she had to go help her mom a race. Anyway, so there's a bunch of dancers here, and we never get to see them dance here. And I don't have a plan, but I have a dream. Anyway, so we went to the show, and it was awesome, you guys. It was fantastic. If you haven't had a chance to see some of the people that are part of this community dance, and you can, just do. But I was sitting there, and we're like two dances in, and the thought came to me, partly because I was thinking about this. This is going to sound a little strange, so just stay with me. The thought came to me, this is useless. This is useless. This has no utility. You can't make anything with this. And you can't. That's the thing about art. That's probably what makes art art. It's what makes play play as well, isn't it? And in some ways, you know, it's what makes joy joy. There's no utility to it. You can't kind of trade on it. So what good is it? And I grew up in a logging town, you know? Not exactly a high culture kind of environment. And this is not a conversation you'd have with very many of the people that I kind of hung out with back then. Did I ever tell you guys a story about my high school friend who, when I came home from Bible college, took me in the back alley and kind of leaned me up against the building and stood there beside me and looked me right in the eye and he said, "So you a fucking priest now or what?" That's where I grew up, okay? Anyway. I guess we should leave that on the podcast. He said it, not me. Yeah. Anyway. Art is useless. But what's its place in the making of shalom? Why do we do this thing? Why does it seem to be like oxygen for us? We can't do without it. Why, when we dig under the dirt and find the remnants of ancient civilizations, do we find art? And why do we find it in places where we know from the other things we're finding this was a civilization that was just hanging on by its fingernails all the time? So what? They had a little break from almost starving to death or almost freezing to death or getting eaten by a big cat with fangs, and they decided to make some art with their spare time. We can't not do this. So how does that work? What's that about? Do you ever wonder why, from the very beginning of the story of the Bible, there are aesthetics in the story? You ever wonder why there's beauty in there, right from go? You ever wonder why the writer takes the time to comment on the shape of the tree, and that it was lovely, and that the fruit of it was pleasing to the eye? Did you ever think that maybe the writer is connecting, right from the beginning of the story, the dot of shalom and beauty? I have a sticker on my base case that says, "Beauty will save the world." It's just there to remind me.
how big an idea this is, how important an idea this is. When we take seriously the idea that we are here to participate in the furtherance of shalom in every realm, all of a sudden, what can happen inside of and around art, just again, it just blossoms. I mean, really, who cares if the garden was beautiful or not? Why is this important? Well, if we think the story starts in chapter 3, then the beauty of the garden becomes nothing but a foil for the ugliness of the fall. It's wildly diminished. If we think the story starts in chapter 1, then beauty means something completely different in this story. It's an essential, foundational truth. Not just something that someday, when we actually evacuate this hellhole, we're going to get to appreciate in fullness. No, something that we're actually here to nurture. Something that we're actually here to make, and make better, and make more, and to augment, because it's already there. If you ever want to kind of get a grip on the redundancy of beauty and creation, read Annie Dillard, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. She just goes off in that book about all the things that are invisible that have to die so other things can live, and what a crazy idea that is, and how lovely it is, as well as how terrible and awe-inspiring it is. Right? You know? This is how this works. You ever wonder about the invisible things of creation? You ever wonder why there's so much beauty in the things that are too small for us to see? Or the things that are too big and too far away for us to see? You ever wonder why God would bother with beauty? Could it be because when we make something as useless as art, we are acting out the deep and important truth that we are much more than what we produce that has utility? I think that's important. 2 weeks ago, and we were all moving around in here painting, and we got a few, Tim was photographing that, and we have a few pictures of that. I just wanted to pop up. He took a bunch, and they're pretty lovely in themselves, as you would expect from somebody with an artful eye. We're moving around in this space, and you can just scroll through those, Natalie. In this space, and we're painting, and I was playing that week, so I was up here with the band, and there was a station that was set up right over here where Dave and Z are sitting roughly. And I was standing on this edge of the stage. And so I'm kind of hear what was happening at that station, right? And I'm playing away. And I'm sort of paying attention to what I'm doing, you know, because I need to. And I overhear Jeremy, who's at the table. And I didn't pick the pictures, honestly, when I picked the story. And I hear Jeremy say, I think I got this right, I was made for this! I found my calling! And he's just like flinging stuff at the paper, and, like his life depended on it. I suspect that he was joking because we all know at this point that Jeremy's calling is actually to make the next great beer. But what happened inside of me out of that experience was that right after that, we kind of finished the song that we were playing, and what popped out of me as a musician was just this little funky little jam that the band picked up. And I when I thought back on it later, I mean, it just happened, right? I mean, you just, when you make music and that's your thing, you just... whatever. But the band picked up on it, and we started to kind of speak to one another musically. We had our own little painting thing going on here, but it was sonic, not visual. And I thought back on it later, and I thought what was going on inside of me is I wanted to, as a musician, I wanted to get to do what was happening in the room, which was artful improvisation, right? It wasn't unfocused. It wasn't like we didn't know why we were doing what we were doing, but we didn't know what we were going to do when we picked up the brush and the paint. We weren't that far down the road. We didn't get to be. And here's a curious thing about this whole thing. I don't want to give too much away here, but Trevor's going to speak to us next week. And I wouldn't be terribly surprised if some of this shows up in where he's going. So you might want to be here for that. I think essentially that, Jeremy, I think that you were right. I think we are made for this. I think that what we were doing in the room that morning, what we're doing lots of times, what we're often doing when we leave here and we go into the rest of life, what we're doing is this ordering and nurturing and furtherance of shalom. And it's a creative act, it's a dynamic act, it's not a static act. We're constantly improvising, we're constantly in the terrain of, I don't know for sure, but I want to tilt this in the direction of shalom. How can I do that? You know what? When we encounter this
If we start thinking about this and we start carrying it in our imagination, one of the things that's going to happen to us is that we're going to start to encounter it in places that we never thought we would. Especially if we grew up with the idea that the only place we encounter what's right and what's good is when we encounter things that are labeled like the religion we grew up with. When we encounter things that are Jesus-y because somebody put a tag on them that said, this is Jesus-y. This is one of the reasons why there's so much bad religious art. And in our time, a lot of it is music. Right? And just like, man, one of my writer friends says, if you can tell how the play's going to end when you're only 5 minutes in, you know it's a bad play. Same thing's true for a song, by the way. You know? Like, my kids, right? I mean, they didn't grow up with this stuff culturally. They kind of have this very strange religious culture that they're growing up in. And they can spot a worship song at like 50 paces in the dark, two chords in. It's like, before anybody says anything, this is a worship song, isn't it? And it's not necessarily a compliment. Anyway, bad music, good music. The point is that when we start to imagine the world this way, we start to encounter shalom in places that are not labeled religions. We start to encounter the beauty of what God has made and its nurturing in places that are not advertising that that's what they're up to. We start to encounter this in religions that are not the one we espouse. We start to encounter this outside of religion entirely. We start to encounter this in science. We start to encounter this in commerce. We start to encounter this in the huge realm of art. But if we don't bust our imaginations out of this, it ain't Jesus-y unless it's labeled Jesus-y mold, we're going to miss all of that. And that is not just sad. That, I think, is the abandonment of mission. I think that is missing the mark. If we think just for a moment, I'll close with this. If we think just for a moment about what was happening when we were painting, and we think of it as taking our creative contributions and gathering them together into a larger process, then we start to understand that the flicking of paint that we were doing and the, you know, the muddling about the creative engagement in that instance and in other instances, that those things are taken, they are ordered even further, they are folded back into the life of the community, all with the hope that this group of people, among other things, can be part of telling the story of how good it can be to share the calling of working with the raw stuff that God has made to make the world a place where there is more and more and more shalom. Until heaven and earth are united in a new beginning, a resurrection on a grand scale, in which shalom is no longer challenged by rebellion and by the stuff of death. Imagine that.